Let's welcome Chelsea Clinton, if we may. It's my pleasure to introduce to you a wonderful new vice president of the Aspen Institute, Jane Wales, who's in charge of our philanthropy and society program and is also a senior advisor of the Clinton Global Initiative. And, of course, to present somebody who, as president of the United States, led us through a decade of peace and prosperity, a time when America's power was used only for good in this world, and when the budget was balanced, and somebody who, as a former president, has not only redefined the role of former president, but helped us understand the true concept of global philanthropy. Jane Wales and the 43rd President of the United States, Bill Clinton.
I guess we turn these on, do we? No, we don't. I want to mention that there is another Clinton here to applaud, and that's Chelsea here in the front seat. I want to open with what's on everyone's mind, Mr. President, the elections in Zimbabwe. After weeks of targeted violence, proposed, what should the world do in response?
Well, first of all, there was a remarkable article in the Washington Post today, which I urge all of you to read. You can pull it off on the internet, but it reminds you what newspapers are for at their best. It was an amazing article. Somehow they got a Zimbabwean reporter working for the Post in the meetings that occurred after the first election in Zimbabwe. And according to the reporter who cites people and quotes them, Mr. Mugabe was actually ready to leave. And the general who's the commander of the armed forces, and they've sort of been running him in the country for some time now, told him in no uncertain terms that that was not his decision alone to make and that they would take care of it. And they proceeded to take care of it. And it describes in excruciating detail whom they decided to target, when they did it, who they decided to beat up, and who they decided to kill. So I think it, if you have any ambivalence at all about how you feel about this, or what sort of options should be considered, I recommend the article to you because it's a stunning piece of public service and journalism, and it's really amazing. Now, what we don't have a lot of options. I think the first thing we have to do is to get more African leaders to do unambiguously what Nelson Mandela did at his 90th birthday party celebration in London the other day and condemn it in no uncertain terms and say he ought to go. I think there are only two potentially acceptable alternatives. One is he ought to go, and the other is if that's not going to happen, they ought to form a unity government, make the man who should be elected president the prime minister. He's no angel, but nobody is in politics. And make him prime minister and let him run the affairs of the country as the majority of the Zimbabweans clearly wanted. If that neither one of those things can happen, then I think the rest of us at least have to do everything we can to keep trying to stiffen the spine of the Africans and offering incentives and trying to figure out what kind of options there are, and maybe there ought to be some sort of high-level person delegated who has some relationship with Mugabe trying to figure out how to walk this back. And maybe there's some military-to-military contacts there that could have some bearing. Secretary Powell will remember, I personally believe that he had an enormous role in the replacement of the Haitian dictator Cedras without a shot being fired, because he went there and talked to the military people and explained to them what their options were. And I think he had a lot more credibility than even the highest level American diplomat would have had at the time. And so maybe Kofi Annan could do something. Maybe there's some other options. But I think the South Africans, I get why historically they've been reluctant to go after Mugabe, because he was the hero of the anti-colonial movement, because he was steadfast in his loyal support of the African National Congress during the whole time Mandela was in prison. So it was a big thing for Mandela to publicly criticize him on the occasion of his 90th birthday. But Zimbabwe is causing South Africa an enormous amount of problems. You have, for the first time in South Africa, anti-immigrant riots more violent than anything that has occurred in the United States among the most fanatic anti-immigrant people here. The crime is going up in all the townships around Johannesburg. They have more AIDS than they would otherwise have. They have more everything than they would otherwise have, because people can't stand living in Zimbabwe anymore, and many increasing numbers of them are afraid. So South Africa is paid and paid and paid for whatever debt they once owed Mugabe. He is not the man he was. He has not been for a very long time. And he is now clearly just, if you believe this article, and I found it profoundly credible, he has become in large measure a puppet of the military establishment that likes controlling the country and looting it. And remember, that was a very rich, great country. We're facing famine. I hope we get a chance to talk about the food crisis later, but we're facing the prospect of all these people dying in Ethiopia and Eritrea, and hunger everywhere, and President Bush is going off to the G8 summit in Hokkaido, Japan, and they were going to talk about meeting the Millennium Development Goals, and now they've first of all got to figure out what they're going to do to keep tons of people from starving. This was a country that could have been Africa's breadbasket, totally destroyed by people for selfish ends of power and money. So I think that, you know, we need to keep the heat up. I don't know. I don't think that there are military options, if that's what you're asking me, at least right now. And I don't think the predicate has been set for that in international law. But I think that he's either got to go, or he's got to take the guy into his government, form a unity government, and let him take the country in a totally different direction.
As you've noted, the economy has been decimated over the years. And the question is, we've seen in post-conflict situations such as Rwanda and Liberia and Mozambique and El Salvador, we've seen economies rebound. What is the role for philanthropy in a post-Mugabe Zimbabwe, the role for philanthropy and for private investment, and for bringing back this talented diaspora?
Well, first of all, keep in mind, when most people think about Africa in America, I bet you if you say, what are the first two words that come to your mind when I say Africa? They would say Zimbabwe and Darfur. But the African continent has been enjoying economic growth as a continent of 5% or more for the last two or three years. Several countries have done much better. I work in a lot of those countries. We have a remarkable development project in Rwanda and Malawi, where in the areas where we work, we've more than doubled agricultural productivity, established new markets. We're working on now adding to the value of the dollar of agricultural produce there. There are no food riots there. People, we're going to be able to get through this tough time. And I thought there was an astonishing recognition by the president of the World Bank, Mr. Zelik, the other day, that the World Bank had been wrong for 20 years to discourage poor countries from developing agricultural self-sufficiency on the theory that other places could produce the food cheaper, get it there, and therefore they could just skip that stage and go straight to industry. And that was clearly wrong. Some of the best work we've done in Africa has been helping farmers who are really smart get the seeds that are quality, get affordable fertilizer, do the other things that will help them to organize their otherwise considerable talents and feed themselves. I think we ought to go in there with all the people, with both public and private efforts, and work on, first of all, reestablishing their stunning agricultural potential, put all those people who have been thrown out of their villages, have a home-building program there. There are enormous numbers of things you can do, but if other African countries with far fewer natural resources can move as they've been moving in the last few years, Mozambique bounced back from that horrible flood remarkably, they could do very well, and there's plenty for all of us to do. And I think it would be a great place for new investment of all kinds. But first you got to get the politics right so people can go in there. I do think as long as they're willing to let NGOs in, that humanitarian assistance should continue. But you're not going to be able to have sustainable growth until the current situation is different.
The president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has said that that Liberia is not a poor country. It's a country that's been managed poorly. Say something about a country that she has come in, brought in remarkably good policies. What she lacks, however, is resources. How important is it that she succeed, that country succeed, and to what degree is it a test of the rest of us to help make that happen?
Well, I think it's a particular test for America because Liberia was founded by freed slaves. And there are only 3 million people there, so it would be a fairly easy thing for us to turn the country around for them to turn their country around with our help. They also are very politically sophisticated. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was opposed in the election after a distinguished career at the World Bank, after having been a political prisoner. She was opposed in the election by the country's only bona fide sort of cultural figure, a soccer star who was movie star handsome, and everybody loved to watch him kick the ball, and he was backed by all the wrong people. And as we say at home, she beat him like a yard dog in the election. So the voters got it. They knew exactly what was going on, and they didn't bite. So you've got a country there where the people voted to take a different direction. I was there a year or so ago because we do AIDS work there, and we're trying to help them rebuild their health systems. And Ellen asked me to meet with college students. And in Monrovia, the capital, at night, even then, only about 20, maximum 25% of any of the buildings had any electricity at night. So I know these young people that I met, these university students, probably had a hard time washing their clothes and ironing them and just doing the things that we take for granted. These kids were dressed to the nines. They were incredibly well-informed. Keep in mind, they don't have daily newspapers. They didn't last year. The people in Monrovia, the capital of the country, went by a local guy who had access to a shortwave radio, and he wrote the headlines of the day up in chalk on a big blackboard. And I thought I could have been at Harvard being grilled by students for an hour and a half. They're immensely impressive people. There's only 3 million of them. They need to get their power system up. They'd be a perfect laboratory for clean energy. They'd be a perfect laboratory for all kinds of industry and self-sufficiency. I took Bob Johnson went with me, and afterward he came back and got some African-American businessmen, and they put together just $30 million to start, and they're doing two things. They're building a hotel to try to rebuild some tourism capacity and to have a good place for would-be investors to stay when they come in. And they've set up microcredit operations to make loans to people who want to go into business and start again. But if you can find a place like Liberia or Rwanda, you know, is the most densely populated country in Africa because it's so small, but they still have only fewer than 9 million people. And they're doing great. And they're trying to preserve their natural resources, including the rainforest necessary to keep the gorillas alive. So I think they're doing great. I think that you ought to pick a place there, Mozambique, Tanzania, there's a gazillion, you know, there are 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and well over half of them could efficiently and effectively use NGO activities and investment, and a lot of you probably are involved there, and you know that this is right. But I think that The trick is for all of us who are in the NGO world is to take things to scale. So I like working in the small countries because you can prove up models in a hurry, take them to scale, and then show other people that they can follow the way.
You mentioned microfinance, and that's become a $4 billion industry around the world. Let's talk a little bit about the role of financial services, not beyond microfinance. Small and medium enterprise funds, efforts to provide for insurance to reduce risk, efforts to provide for savings and build assets. What role do those play?
Well, they all have a role, but the bigger you get in the institutions, the more you need a certain legal framework, and the more you may need some involvement from the international institutions or national aid programs. I have a friend in New York, Alan Patrickoff, who's done a lot of work on the financing just above the microfinance level. And we do need that, but... And if you really need good government, and you need good laws and good systems to do it. If you can get that, then probably most of that money will be public. There may be some foundations big enough to fund such things to start. But the better way to do that is if you know that property rights and contractual rights are protected, then most of those places should be ripe for good investment because there are real serious growth opportunities there. A lot of these countries could be growing at 7, 8, 9% a year if they had more investment and some more capacity at the governmental level. One of the reasons I like to go in with our foundation and work with governments is that I'm always trying to help build systems so that if something happens to me or our foundation can't work anymore or whatever happens, the capacity of people through organization will be greater. I say this every year when I come here, but I'll say it again because it's like a broken record that's worth hearing the scratch on. Intelligence and effort are evenly distributed. Organization, opportunity, and investment aren't. Very often the biggest problem is organization. Systems are more important than any of us think. We are sitting here, and you are going to be able to listen to me drone on because you have every confidence that those fans will not go off in the middle of this encounter. You would be shocked if the lights went out or the mics didn't work anymore. And those of us who work in the poorest countries of the world deal with people who are just as smart as we are, who are working harder than we do every day, who can't take any of that for granted. General Powell came from an immigrant family, became the chief officer of the United States military, mostly by dint of his own merit and effort, but also because the military had a system where there was a predictable set of consequences for the efforts he was willing to undertake. It is a terrible thing to have hundreds of millions, even billions of people living their whole lifetimes as guerrillas, in effect, where every day they have to get up and they're not sure there's a predictable set of consequences for the efforts they're willing to undertake. So, yes, all that's important. But you need to think about it in that big term. Every time I go anywhere to do anything, doesn't matter what the subject is, climate change or healthcare or whatever, I try to think there's some kid that's just as smart as I was when I was that age, and we need to give that child an arc of predictability for effort.
Good policy, good systems. The combination of good policies and good systems. Absolutely. And General Powell will probably be the first to say good leaders as well. Aspen Institute is very committed to strengthening leadership of folks from around the world. How important is individual ingenuity, sort of the courage, the boldness, the willingness to take risks?
It's really important. But I think you mentioned the military. The whole premise of the military is that leaders are made as well as born, and that, you know, you can train people for this. I think they're out there. And I think it's important that it's pivotal? I wouldn't be giving this little riff about Liberia if Ellen Johnson Sirleaf had lost the election. So it is absolutely necessary, but it is not sufficient. I'll give you my best example. 170 nations signed the Kyoto Accord. It was flawed, but it was the best we could do at the time, and I thought it was worth doing. if you ask any environmentalist in America, they will tell you, oh, the biggest tragedy was the United States government got out of the treaty. All President Bush did, frankly, was to formalize the decision the U.S. Senate had already made with a bipartisan majority. They thought Al Gore and I were nuts to agree to Kyoto, and the world would come to an end and all that. Okay, so everybody knows that story. But I think a bigger tragedy is this. 170 countries did sign Kyoto. It required them all to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions below 1990 levels by 2012, right, by a varying amount. About 15 countries, give or take, had to make no effort to do that because they were part of the communist bloc. They were either part of the Soviet Union or part of the Warsaw Pact. Their economies collapsed after the Berlin Wall fell and communism disappeared. They were old-fashioned, industrial, coal-based, inefficient economies. So no matter how much they grew after 1991, they're not going to get back to the greenhouse gas emissions of 1990, okay? So take them off. 155 nations had to try. How many are going to meet their Kyoto targets? Answer, somewhere between 6 and 8. Now, we're talking about leadership. Does that mean that all these other countries had stupid, lazy, incompetent, dishonest leaders? No. The vast majority of them elected the best person they could elect at the time. They were honest people. They were well-meaning. They worked hard. They were not willing to stay poor. And there were no systems available. Nobody figured out how this thing could be sold not as castor oil, but as the greatest economic opportunity since the West organized to fight World War II. To mobilize the economic resources of a country and revolutionize it in a way that is positive. And there were no systems put in place to do that. So look at the countries that did it. Denmark's growing like crazy because they're going to beat their Kyoto targets. The United Kingdom has done very well until this recent crushing increase in energy prices because they're going to beat their Kyoto targets. And the same is true for all the other countries that are going to do it. They have found that it is a job generator because they were organized properly to treat it as an opportunity. So I will say again, I like in this presidential campaign, both our candidates have positions which guarantee to a virtual certainty, unless there's a filibuster in the Senate by the dinosaurs, which I don't think will happen, that there will be a price set on carbon and we'll try to start doing something serious about climate change. But the Energy Department has a study that says enough wind blows between West Texas and the Canadian border with North Dakota and Montana, even when the politicians aren't talking, to electrify America in theory. You can't do it because most of the wind blows where a few people live, and there are no transmission systems set up to reroute the electricity that the windmills could generate into the grid and then move it out again. So that's a simple example, but I'm trying to make a point. Is leadership important? Absolutely. It is necessary. It is nowhere near sufficient. I have seen many good leaders who are failing on the climate change front because they didn't have a system set up either to conserve energy to its maximum possible affordable degree in a way that's economically beneficial or to move to energy that's free of greenhouse gas production.
I'm going to take you back to climate later, or else you're going to take me back to climate later, I know. But let me just stick with the notion of leadership for a moment. Nelson Mandela turns 90 in a couple of weeks. He is someone with whom you've been extremely close over the years. I wanted you to say a word about what he has meant, not only to South Africa, to Africa, to the world, but also to say something about what he's meant to you personally.
Well, I think the importance of his life for all of us is that first of all, he proved that he really did give up his freedom in almost a full third of his life so that everybody could be free, including his oppressors. He paid as high a price as you can pay without getting killed for it to prove that freedom has to be a universal commodity. And then he governed in a way that was consistent with what he said. Everybody knows, for example, that he invited his jailers to his inauguration not as many people know, that he put the leaders of all the groups that oppressed him into his cabinet. And keep in mind, he was elected with 2/3 of the vote, so he did not have to do that. There is no constitutional system in the world that would have required him to do it. He did it because he knew that the country could not govern without the skills and knowledge and the psychological balance that would be provided by doing that. So he did that. That's the first thing he did. The second thing he did, which is very important in the Mugabe case, is to show us that you don't have to be in office to do public service. You can do much public good as a private citizen, and your ability to do it is enhanced if you leave office as required by the laws of your country with good grace, and then you use the stature you acquired from having held the job to try to continue to be of public service. And he did it in his later years when no one would have blamed him if he had retreated to that amazing game preserve he has up that a friend of his built him a house in northern South Africa. And the third thing he did was to show us all how to live. That's the thing he meant most to me about. I mean, he just, you know, he really did realize that if you read his memoirs, I wrote about this in my book, but he said, I told him that the day he was released for the last time, and you may all remember, it was beautifully staged for television. It was on an early Sunday morning in the United States, and he took one long last walk and down a dusty road, went through a gate, and then got in a car and rode away. I said to him, now tell me the truth. I said, I know you're a great man, but you're also a great politician. And you did the right thing getting all those people in your government. But when you were taking those last steps, didn't you really relive those 27 years and didn't you hate them again? He said, sure I did. It's great, you know, you reach a certain age and you're not running for anything, you can pretty well say what you want. And he said, sure I did. For a moment I did. He said, I felt anger and hatred and fear. And I realized that if I kept hating them once I got in that car and got through the gate, I would still be in prison. So I let it go because I wanted to be free. There is every living soul on the planet has some often highly justified anger. Everybody. And just learning that you have to practice. And by the way, I said this at his birthday. I'm probably one of the few people who's actually seen him mad on more than one occasion. You know, it's just like if you know anybody who was ever a POW for any length of time, you will see that, you know, you go along for months or maybe even years, and then something will happen that will trigger all those bad dreams, and they'll come back, and it may not last 30 seconds. Look, that's the thing that makes his life so monumental. It's not like all that stuff just went away. But he disciplined himself and his mind and his heart and his spirit to always work to constantly overcome it every day. And I think in some ways, when you look at how we're going to, what will happen in the aftermath of Mugabe's going, there will be an enormous, let's suppose the best of all worlds happened and he woke up tomorrow and he says, I've had a terrible attack of conscience. I'm tired of this general running me. I don't care how old I am. I have some good sense left. I'm out of here. Goodbye. I love my country. I wish you well. Think of all the people on the other side who would be tempted to go kill other people. I mean, this is a universal lesson that all of us have to keep struggling with in our lives. So I think he proved freedom has to be a universal commodity. He served with enormous distinction out of office as well as in. And he taught us a lot about how all of us should be trying to live. And that's for those three things are why I think he along with Itzhak Rabin, are the two most remarkable people I ever knew.
You worked very closely with him on HIV/AIDS. Say something about his own experience with that, with his own family, but also your partnership with him.
Well, it's interesting. Mandela met a woman who, not South African. When we were at the AIDS conference in Barcelona in 2002, at that time, in the entire world, if you had HIV and it blew into AIDS and you needed medicine to stay alive, if you were in America or Europe or Japan or Canada, you could get it. If you were in a poor country or even an emerging economy, almost nobody was on medicine and people were just dying. There were 6 million people then, almost, who needed the medicine to stay alive, and only 200,000 were getting it. 130,000 of those people were in Brazil, where the government, under a brilliantly conceived and executed program by the then president, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, figured out how not only to get this medicine, but to actually get it to people in a way that they could take it. Whole rest of the world, 70,000 people. So Mandela was trying to both convince the South African government to abandon a totally untenable position that they didn't need the medicine, and also trying to convince the world to raise more money. Keep in mind, this was before the president's PEPFAR program had been passed, and after the Global Fund on AIDS, TB, and malaria had been stood up, but before it was funded. So Mandela and I were asked to go there in a very different world, where we were supposed to be head of a group of people, used-to-be's like us, who were supposed to hit on people who were still had money to give it, governments. Basically, that's why they asked us to close the session. But I was overwhelmed because he talked about this woman, this young woman who was lived in the Asia, in the Pacific, in one of the Pacific Island countries. I can't even remember which one now. And he had run across her at an AIDS meeting, and he was so moved by her that he personally saw to it that his foundation paid for the medicine to keep this girl alive so she could go out and be a spokesperson. Now, that might not sound like much to you now, but there was the medicine was terrifically expensive then, and this girl was not even African. She had not even anywhere on the continent. He just did it because he thought, one, he was moved by her as a human being, and secondly, he wanted her to be out there as a beacon to other people. So he said to me, he said, you know, this is what you ought to be doing. And it became obvious to me that when President Bush got the extra money and then the Global Fund was funded, which is really great, and more people were putting up money, that most people were going to keep dying because the medicine was too expensive and there were no delivery systems. So that's how we got into doing what we do. And now, there, since that time, there are about 3 million people in the world on medicine now, so 2.8 million have been added, and 1.4 million get the medicine off the contracts that our foundation has negotiated, which are the world's least expensive programs, including, thanks to the French-led group Unitaid, about 150,000 more young children who have to have the pediatric AIDS medicine. But I started thinking about it there when I was just looking at him, and I thought, here's this guy. He's, how old was he in 1994? He's 90 now. What, he was 83? He's there writing a check, so a young girl that he would never, may never see again, from the Pacific Ocean region, can live her life and be a model. He's an astonishing man.
Now you negotiated with private companies to lower the prices of their drugs to allow to make them affordable to the world's poorest. What are other market-based solutions to health problems that you've seen in action? Clearly, we've got to leverage markets because that's where R&D is.
You can do that in a lot of places because if you think about it, a lot of people who serve very poor people are providing a product or a service at low volume and somewhat uncertain payment. Therefore, they have to claim a bigger margin on what they do sell and do get paid for. So that even these generic drug providers, when we began, were charging, I don't know, the list price was about $500 a year for your basic first-line aid drugs. And we cut it to first 140. I think we got it to 135 or less now. And the whole world price structure has collapsed to within 20% of that now. So anybody, even not involved with us, can get the medicine cheaper. And then the pediatric medicine was $600 a person, and 550,000 little kids were dying every year, and only 10,000 were getting the medicine. because it was $600. Even though there were fewer component parts, the volume was so small and the money available to it so limited. And to be fair, even the Global Fund and the American money wasn't being used for pediatric AIDS medicine for the simple reason that there were all these young adults dying like flies, and they needed the medicine, and it was less expensive. I mean, if you had to, those were the kinds of decisions that were being made. So the Children's Trust in England, Chris and Jamie Cooper-Hahn, gave me enough money to double that to $10,000 more. And then we negotiated a deal with the major Indian manufacturers of the children's medicine to take it from $600 to $190 a year. And then the French, the best thing that the French government's done, I think, in my whole experience, they put this minor charge on international air flights and created this fund called UNITAID, and then got 19 other countries to contribute to it. And the money is used to buy medicines to deal with the problems of the poor throughout the world. So they ask our foundation to try to use a substantial allocation to deal with the pediatric drugs for the little kids, because it's not like an aspirin. You can't just cut adult AIDS medicine in half and give it to kids. They can't digest it. It won't work. And they ask us to do the second-line AIDS medicine. That is, get 10 to 15% of all the people being kept alive on AIDS medicine will eventually need different medicine because the first will play out in its effectiveness. Anyway, we wound up getting the medicine down to $60, from $600 to $60, simply by reorganizing the market, saying we're going to go from a low-volume, high-margin, uncertain payment business to a very high-volume, very low-margin, absolutely certain payment business. Everybody still makes money. I don't want any of these drug manufacturers to lose money. And we've gotten a lot of help, by the way, not from mainstream pharmaceutical and other companies who helped us with the testing equipment, because there's no generic production of that, and who are also getting interested in these other medicines. But essentially, you can do it right across the board. In Rwanda and Malawi, where we work with farmers, we did the same thing with fertilizer. Higher volume, lower margin, certain payment, improve the distribution chain, cut the cost of the producers and the suppliers. It's essentially what we do with building retrofits and the climate change initiative in big cities. Just cut the cost of all the materials that they have to use to make the buildings more efficient by ramping the volumes way up and making sure the payment is certain. It's a simple little thing that philanthropy ought to be doing everywhere, just changing the business model. And all of a sudden, tons more people's lives get saved.
I was planning to ask you, Mr. President, what's new with fertilizer, but I thought that might shorten my tenure at the Aspen Institute. I just wasn't so sure.
I'll tell you what's new with fertilizer. It costs a heck of a lot more unless it's organic, because it's got so much petroleum in it. And it's another thing that's really complicating this. It's complicating agriculture. And I'll just say one thing about this food crisis. I'll make you a prediction. I think within 30 years, if not before, in every place in the world, people will be consuming a much higher percentage of food grown within 150 miles of where they live. Everywhere. I believe that. And so I think, as again, I'll pat old Bob Zoellick on the back. The idea that the World Bank wants to get back into funding agricultural self-sufficiency in developing countries is very important, but we need to be looking at it in America, too. You're going to see this everywhere. I think it's a national security issue and an energy issue. Mr. Chertoff's got a lot of things to worry about, but the fact that every American sits down to a meal where the average distance traveled by a lot of that food is over 1,000 miles, if you really wanted to fool with America's psyche, if you tried to interrupt the food chain, it's so centralized it would be one thing you could do. I mean, there are lots of energy and other implications to this that I think will play out. So the fertilizer issue is very important, and how we grow food is important.
Say something about, I mean, we've got the short-term food crisis, and then we've got the long-term crisis that stems from this vast increase in demand, particularly as China and India develop further. Say something about the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA, and what its prospects are, whether that's an important innovation.
Yeah, I think it's an important innovation. You have to be we have to be mindful. Whenever you change the natural crop productivity at a given point in human history, you will both strengthen your ability to get much higher yields and make the strains more vulnerable to invasion later on. But I think that in general, we have to do whatever we can to increase agricultural productivity in Africa. I think that, look, I'm all for reducing the subsidies that Europe and the U.S. give to agricultural products. And now's the time when the prices are high that we should be doing that. But the truth is, there are two other things we could do that would be easier to do politically that would do much more good in the next 10 years. One is to really get the show on the road trying to replicate the results of these little Millennium Development Villages and the results we've had in Rwanda and Malawi in dramatically increasing productivity in Africa within each country and other poor countries as well, and then removing trade barriers between these countries and their neighbors. And the second thing we should do is to change the way we deliver food aid, because now, except in very limited circumstances, 100% of our food has to be delivered, has to be grown in America, and then delivered to the nearest port where the hunger crisis is on American flagships, or at least 75% of it does. Canada stopped that a couple of years ago and started giving 50% of their food aid and just cash assistance to the farmers next nearest the crisis. The money goes further. It provides more food. It helps the local agricultural economy. It does all kinds of good. For 3 years, President Bush has been trying to do that with 25% of our aid. It's one of the few things that we really are in complete agreement on, and we're just as isolated. The Democrats and the Republicans just beat the living daylights out of this proposal. It's a modest proposal. Farm prices are high. It is absurd for us with all these people facing starvation in Ethiopia and Eritrea. And we've got a lot of, you know, national security interests nearby. We've got an operation in Djibouti. We've got all this stuff going on in Somalia. You've got hunger problems in Somalia. For us to be holding on to this, when this is money already appropriated, you're not going to increase the deficit. We could send that money over there, empower farmers, make friends for America, and save lives. It's crazy for us to hold on to this old way of distributing food aid. And I see my old Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, nodding his head, and he's from Kansas. We should do this. If you want to do something really good in the short run that would help, not this year, but next year in this, write your senator or congressman of whatever party and ask him to support changing the way we distribute food aid.
I just want to note that Dan Glickman's not an old Secretary of Agriculture. He's the former Secretary of Agriculture, and I just want to say that. You know, Paul Collier was one of the speakers offering big ideas, and one of the things he noted, he said that our great folly was subsidies for corn-based ethanol, and Europe's great folly is its aversion to genetically modified foods. How easy, if he's right, assuming he's right, you can contradict him if he's wrong, but assuming he's right, how easy would it be to make a mid-course correction and remove those subsidies, number one, for corn-based ethanol, and number two, how easy would it be to change attitudes within Europe toward genetically modified foods?
Well, let's talk about corn-based ethanol first. I think what happened was when we got into corn-based ethanol, even all the – I mean, I spent, you know, a lot of time in corn country this year. And you can – I don't think – most of those corn farmers, they never thought this was a long-term deal. They thought America would be going to a system of biofuels where the conversion ratios were much more efficient. No one thought that you would have this astonishing collision of events where the oil would get to $145 a barrel in a hurry, and you'd have the food crisis around the world, and the diversion of farmland to ethanol production would create explosion in wheat prices, wheat shortages, all these things. I think there are always unintended consequences to any good thing. That, you know, If you want to go to electric cars, which is what I favor, you better have a plan to recycle and store those batteries, or you're going to contaminate groundwater. So, I mean, there's no free lunch in any environmental decision. Let's just posit this. This is not an easy thing. But I think the attraction of corn is that it has the cheapest conversion cost to ethanol. You know, you have to basically, it's an enzyme process. You have to reduce it to a sugar. You can do it cheaply, but it only produces 2.3 gallons of fuel for every gallon of gasoline required to produce it. And it's 30% less efficient, so the conversion ratio is very low. It obviously would be better for us to use field grasses of all kinds, the leavings of all farm crops, kitchen grease to make biodiesel, any of this stuff. All the other cellulosic alternatives will give you 4 gallons to one, but the conversion process is still more than twice as expensive. So I don't think the answer, I think biofuels can be an important bridge and you can do it without raising food prices. You can do it without depleting the soil if you do it right. If we're going to move out of corn-based ethanol and the subsidies there, we should think of, in my opinion, having a more appropriate subsidy for more constructive biofuels alternatives. Because we don't, for example, eventually we may get to hydrogen cars, but I think I've been in every hydrogen car manufactured in America and a couple manufactured in Europe, and the cheapest one's $250,000. And you're not going to get a tax credit of $250,000 a car. So I think where we need to be going is to responsible biofuels and plug-in electrics. For a $10,000 tax credit for plug-in electrics, with technology now available, we could be producing cars tomorrow that get 100 miles a gallon in town. I talked to a man this year that's driving one of 50 demonstration vehicles with a technology manufactured in Massachusetts that you don't even have to change the production lines onto the current hybrids. You just produce the hybrids and put a booster pack on it. Gives you 40 more miles a day on the battery. Means you can drive to 40 miles an hour before you go into fuel. Takes you to 100 miles a gallon in town. Another good national security issue, because half of all the cars in America are driven 25 miles a day or less, almost all in town. They might not ever need fuel again. Just for this one, Israel's going to have 100,000 of these cars by 2010. We could do it. We do not have the capacity at the moment to manufacture enough batteries. General Motors has talked to these people about putting them in two new vehicles they're coming out with. So we should be doing all of this. But I don't think we ought to paint all these corn farmers as demons. They were doing what seemed to be reasonable at the time, and they're not the first people not to understand that there are unintended consequences to every good thing. And so I do think that all these manufacturing facilities, by the way, they've been built in the Middle West, they can all be converted to make ethanol out of cellulosic material. There's no sweat there, so none of the infrastructure is going to be wasted. All the same farmers can make money. They'll just make money in a different way, and you'll still be setting aside land and conservation reserve and not be depleting it if we go to cellulosic ethanol. There needs to be a plan for somebody who understands both the chemistry and the economics better than I do to make that transition in a hurry. But you should not believe that this will answer the food crisis, because it is probably at most 10% of the explosion in prices. Now, as to the genetically modified crops, I think everybody should be entitled to do whatever they think is appropriate to promote safety. And that's those, instead of our saying, you have to eat this now because otherwise we're all going to die, this debate should continue, and they should win the debate. I don't think this is there'll be more evidence every year. We'll know more about it, and America does it. And I know of no problem with most of the anything that I have had any contact with. I think it's just a debate we ought to have to win, but we shouldn't treat these people like they're just Chicken Littles. We have a lot of unanswered questions because of the way we produce and consume food and medicine and chemicals and drinks and everything else. And I think we shouldn't treat these people lightly. We should treat them with respect and try to win the debate in an old-fashioned, honorable way. Because as far as I know, there's nothing wrong with the GMOs that most of our people do produce and consume. And so I'm not accusing people, but I'm just saying you don't treat these people like they're crazy. I'll just give you one example. I had one new experience in this election season with real voters I had never had before. I met people, huge numbers of people with autistic children, because we have tripled the number of children born with autistic conditions in 15 years. And no one knows why. Now, most of the parents groups think it's because of mercury residue from mandatory vaccinations. A lot of people think it's because of the changing composition of our food. No one knows. They just think. And I think I read everything I can about it because I was shocked by the number of families that I met. Kids anywhere from kids that had to walk off and stand in a corner and couldn't communicate to a young man with Asperger's who became president of his class because he learned to manage it and do all this. I mean, but I just think that I sympathize with the comment that was made. I'm actually on the guy's side on the GMO based on everything I know. But I don't think we should treat people who have questions about the miracles of modern breeding as if they're all kooks. I think we ought to just keep working and trying to win arguments.
I'm going to take you, when we think about climate, we think about primarily about transportation. But I've just learned the other day that 70% of the emissions come from the world's cities. What are you doing and what should others be doing to help retrofit cities? And what might this imply for jobs in those cities? Majora Carter has been here. Van Jones has been here. And both have talked about green jobs as an opportunity to revitalize some of our urban economy.
Well, let's talk about that. First of all, actually, it's almost 75% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions are emitted in urban areas, and the percentage is going up because that's only 2% of the land. And most of the rest of it is methane and nitrous oxide coming out of agriculture. And, you know, a little bit in the small towns and rural areas. I think we should pick the low-hanging fruit. I saw a study that was given to me by Mark gave it to me from Goldman Sachs last year that said that if the United States and India, China, and Russia, didn't even mention Europe and Canada, by the way, just U.S., India, China, Russia, were to achieve Japanese levels of energy efficiency, and I'm talking about baseline efficiency. They didn't mean turning the thermostat up to 80 in the summer and 65 in the winter. That would take the world 25% of the way home toward reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050. Now, all the low-hanging fruit here is in energy efficiency. But because it requires millions and millions of decisions, you need a system and an organization that does not now exist in most places. Majora Carter proved that she's from the South Bronx, which is the poorest congressional district in America and had the least green space per capita of any place in the country. And the Congress had appropriated money for a waterside park, but no money to maintain it, no money to hire people, no money to train people. And so she got into proving that, you know, if you put more green space up, it would suck up greenhouse gas emissions and improve the quality of life. Otherwise, the South Bronx was being used as a garbage dump for New York City, literally the collection for garbage. So we should look for systematic things that we could all hook into. And I'll give you just two examples. What we try to do, when I started this climate change initiative with the 40 big cities on six continents, and we're now working with the National League of Cities, it's 1,100 cities in America. In addition to that, only $5 billion was being spent in the entire world on building retrofits to use less energy. Now, that's just unbelievable. A square block of downtown New York is worth $5 billion. So we raised $5 billion more in an afternoon in terms of bank commitments and changed the system. We said that we would start with the public buildings, with the schools, the colleges, the government buildings, then go to hospitals, auditoriums, eventually include big commercial buildings, and hopefully go down to all the residential facilities, and have an energy service organization take responsibility for doing a retrofit analysis in which they will tell you what you can do to typically they'll say if you do the following 10 things, you can cut your greenhouse gas emissions and your utility bill between 20 and 50%. So let's just take 30%. Let's take the New York Housing Authority, because that's, I'll tell you, we're doing that's 11% of America's public housing stock. Most of the buildings are old. We estimate that we'll be able to cut their annual electric bill by from $500 million to $350 million a year by retrofitting all the buildings. And mostly it'll be just green roofs, different windows, different lightings, automatic temperature and lighting controls. Maybe we'll be able to do some smart metering. I'm not sure yet. We're working on that. Okay, the Energy Service Organization will guarantee those savings if you pay them a premium for their analysis. You get two good things out of that. First of all, they'll always be conservative. You're almost always going to save more than they say you're going to save because they'll guarantee it. But once they guarantee it, that means that any bank will loan the housing authority the money to buy the materials, train the workers, hire them, and do all the work and create all those jobs on condition that the loan will be paid back only from utility savings. Because the Energy Service Organization has guaranteed it, which means if you don't make the utility savings, they make up the difference. Now, think of the implications just for public institutions. It means you can do that in every school building in America where you work that financing out, and hard-pressed school budgets don't pay a penny. Every university in the country should go through. Universities emit 6% of America's greenhouse gases, colleges and universities. Every one of them should immediately be in an aggressive retrofit program, and they can get this done without raising tuition. And then as soon as you pay the bill off, you immediately have lower power bills, you've reduced greenhouse gas emissions, and you've created a double ton of jobs. And all you did was change the system so that it works for everybody. The Chicago Merchandise Mart, the biggest building in the country, is doing it now. Sears Tower is. Los Angeles has got a lot of buildings in it. We're working all over the country on this. But you can do it everywhere. And Duke Power Company's executive, who got a great article in the New York Times Sunday magazine not very long ago, Jim Rogers, has an even better idea. He would put me out of business because he thinks that every utility in America should be required to offer these audits on every structure within their service area and split the savings immediately with the ratepayers. And the reason they could do it is if I come fix your home and I cut your power bill 30%, then you're giving me back free power at a lower cost than it would make me to build a new nuclear power plant or a new coal-fired plant once we put a price on coal. So the way Rogers wants to do it is they do it. You put in smart meters. He said if he could just put in smart meters in all of Duke Power Company's area and shut all appliances off when they're not in use so they don't take the kind of continuing drag on it, that alone would obviate the need for two new coal-fired power plants. If you changed all the light bulbs in the country quicker, it could save 80 coal-fired power plants between now and the end of the century. So this is a really big deal. And if the utilities did it, the way they could give you savings immediately, so you could actually give money to every school, money to every hospital, money to every government building, is that they can pay for this, unlike a consumer loan, over 20 years as if it were a power plant. Treat every building as a mini power plant. So they can start splitting the savings immediately with the ratepayers. But these are the kinds of things we need to be doing. We have the money is there to be made. The environmental gain is there to be made. We are not organized to make it. We're not organized on the conservation side. We're not organized on the clean energy side. Will it help if there's a price on carbon? Yes. Will it help if there are much bigger tax incentives? Yes. There have to be some to make the car transitions. And you may have to have help with some of the capital cost of putting modern transmission systems to capture the full capacity America has for wind, both on and offshore. But the systems are not in place. You put these simple systems in place, the American people will do the rest, and you'll create millions and millions of jobs.
I'm going to take our last few minutes to just throw.
I didn't have, This is not just a thing for the rich. I'm going to Ethiopia in a couple of weeks. The Prime Minister of Ethiopia did a soil analysis and said they could grow sugarcane just like they do in Brazil without tearing down any rainforest, and Africa could become oil-free in terms of transportation with ethanol. Cane ethanol gets you 8 gallons for every 1 gallon of gasoline. There are all kinds of things that could be done. We're working in India on wastewater treatments and other things that all of which save energy, which create jobs and improve the quality of life. So, again, we've got projects in Beijing and Shanghai that I tried to get put on a fast track before the Beijing Olympics because they could have taken. Now they're going to have to shut down a lot of activities for a couple of weeks, you know, before the Olympics, so people can train and breathe and compete. But if they retrofitted all their buildings, you'd be amazed what it would do to air quality. So this is something that is not just for America and other wealthy countries. It's something everybody can do and make money out of it.
I'm going to use the next couple of minutes to throw a few of the big ideas at you that have emerged over the last week. Thomas Jefferson wasn't here. It was just some oversight. But he said that education is the bedrock of democracy. What are the big ideas for improving our educational system?
In America or around the world?
You can go for both if you only have 2 minutes.
Well, I will grossly oversimplify the world problem, but let me just say this. And I think Tom Friedman said something about this. I read the articles in the local newspaper. Everything we want to do on climate change and food security and you name it is complicated by the fact that the world's population is estimated to grow from 6.5 to 9 billion by the year 2050, the same year we're supposed to have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. And almost all these people are going to live in cities. And most of these people are going to be born in countries not fully able to support the people who live there now. Given the all the cross currents that you see in our country and around the world, with people's religious and other feelings about population control and family planning and everything, there is really one foolproof way to slow the world's population growth in a way that will not violate the values of any religion. And that is to dramatically accelerate our efforts to put every single girl in the world in school. And 60% of the unschooled, 130 million unschooled, and a disproportionate percent of the children who are in school but not really, that is, they have no learning materials, they have no trained teachers, they have no facilities, they have no nothing, are girls. If you put all the girls of the world in school and then ensure they have some access to the labor market, in every society, without regard to religion or culture, where this has been done, there is always a delay in the age of marriage and the delay of in the age in which the first child is born. That it is the one of the few sort of social science phenomenons for which I can find no exception in any culture. Therefore, if you're worried about this and you want to do something that's helps with energy, helps with climate change, helps with poverty, helps with food security, support an NGO that's and a government that's committed to educating all the girls. I mean, I'm to tell you, so that's my one big idea for education globally. There are many others, but in America, the fundamental problem is that we have good colleges and universities, and we're not doing as well in K through 12. We have a more diverse student body in income and ethnicity and first language than almost any country on earth. And we still are basically in an agricultural age education framework. Now, what we have to decide is whether we can go through the 21st century making up the difference the way we've made up the difference for the last 50 years. That is, the way we made up the difference from World War II till, you know, a little while ago, a few years ago, was we just sent more people to college than anybody else. And we had vocational training programs. And we had employer-based training programs. And we brought a lot of immigrants in who provided a lot of juice in 1,000 different ways. I don't think it's very smart for us to continue to go on spending a fortune on systems that aren't as good as they should be. Now, Eli and Edie Broad are here. I think the Broad Foundation's probably spent more money than anybody in America, maybe even including the Gates Foundation, trying to improve public schools in America. So you ought to ask him what he thinks when I leave. But I think part of it's a leadership problem. Better superintendents, better principals. Part of it is a governance problem. You need to know, first of all, let's look at the data. The data from reliable international tests say that American kids actually do pretty well compared to our counterparts at the fourth grade level, particularly considering the percentage of our kids whose first language is not English. That the gap shows up at the eighth grade level, and then it's a chasm in high school. Now, they go to school longer. They start the hard courses earlier. They don't have all these different governance units. They have national standards for these courses, which they have worked on for decades. And relative to other professions in all these countries, they pay the teachers more, train them harder, and retrain them for a lifetime. Are there all kinds of other social and economic problems, community by community? Of course there are. But, you know, my candidate for the big idea there is that we have to move in some way toward local operational control, but a national commitment to a longer school year, to better trained and better paid teachers, to principals and superintendents that can actually be held accountable for results. I don't think No Child Left Behind works for any but the most poorly performing schools, because the states get to pick the test and the passing score. So for a lot of these schools, they're putting more and more resources into that. 80% of our schools have cut back on history, on political science, on a lot of other things, and physical education and music, to spend more time teaching to the test. And if the kids are not able to read by the eighth grade, then No Child Left Behind will do some good in those places. It really will do some good. But you're talking maybe, what, 5, 10%, 15% at the outside of the kids. We ought to move to a genuine evaluative test that is given 3 times in an academic career, and that is established in a non-political way by the national board, NAGBE, it's called, the people who do the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is a pretty reliable test, but it's only given to a representative sample. I think that the big idea there is this has to become a national crusade while finding some way for local people to continue to have input. But to pretend that you can go to school as little as we go, have a system as bureaucratized and accountability avoiding as ours is, and pay the teachers as little as we pay and get a better product, I think is illusory. And by the way, let me just say one thing. By the way, there are schools in America and kids in America are doing very, very well. And so my one other big idea is this. Find the 20 schools in America, elementary, middle, and high schools, that are today internationally competitive. Figure out what they're doing right and pay to do it everywhere else. That's the way, you know, you think about the No Child Left Behind deal. Suppose General Powell, as a young captain, had 3 units under his command, and they had to do target practice. And 2 of them were the best in the Army, and in the 3rd one, nobody could hit the broadside of a barn with a rifle from 100 feet. Right? You wouldn't give them a driver's license. They could do. What would you do? Would you give them all 5 tests? Would you cut off their Army funding when they didn't shoot well? I mean, think of the analog that Leave No Child Behind. No, you'd figure out how come the other guys could shoot and figure out how to do that and do that in the 3rd unit. This is not rocket science. We turn this into something it's not. We have stubbornly refused to replicate excellence in American education, and we have paid one hell of a high price for it, I think.
last question for you. We've spent the week hearing about and struggling with very large problems and some large solutions. But there's been a spirit of optimism throughout. And a lot of that spirit has come from a sense that the next generation is an idealistic generation, a generation that will do, that will serve, that has a sense of community. You've spent the last several months, for some family reason, traveling around the country with Chelsea. Say a word to the young people who have come here to Ideas Fest about what you see in them.
Well, first of all, I think that people, you should be highly optimistic. First of all, nobody knows. Let's just take climate change. Everybody knows something bad's going to happen, and it's going to be really bad, and nobody knows when, and we're all estimating that, right? So the world is always full of those kind of problems. I mean, we labored through decades of a Cold War when it would have been really bad if a nuclear bomb had gone off. And climate change, in a way, has the capacity to do even more damage. But the point is, you can't afford to live your life that way. This generation of young people has been empowered by the Internet, access to information, and is the most socially active generation ever in terms of non-political things, trying to work through non-governmental groups to do things. That's why we had our global initiative this year had a whole separate thing just for university kids at Tulane, and we had students from 40 states and 15 countries show up. And that I've never seen more invigorated young people. I couldn't run our AIDS project has 500 people, and a third of them are working for room and board and travel. They're not making any money. They're just young people who want to go out there and save lives and have an experience where they think they're making the world a better place. So I am actually quite optimistic about this. I think what is important, however, is that every young person realizes that this kind of service is not an option in an interdependent world. I applaud this generation of young people because it was an option and they took it. But in an interdependent world where government cannot solve all the problems and there will always be a gap in the bounty any private sector will produce and the social dislocations that the government can close, every citizen, the definition of citizenship in the 21st century will be get an education, obey the law, go to work, pay your taxes, be an informed citizen, vote for the people you think will do the best job, and figure out what you can do, you, to join with like-minded people to make positive changes in the public good. That I think that's the one thing I would say, that we have to change the definition of citizenship so you can't pat yourself on the back for paying your taxes, obeying the law, taking care of your family, and being a good voter. You have to be a public servant as a private citizen. The interdependent world demands it. If we do it, I'm very optimistic. And I'd just like to say one last thing in closing about this. These problems are hard. If they were simple, we wouldn't be here talking about them. Somebody just go out and do it. We'd be talking about something else. They require dialogue. It's easy for Americans to say, gosh, how intolerant the Taliban is. You know, we don't want them to get a hold of Afghanistan again. They were so horrible to the women, to the girls, so repressive and all that. But one of the things that bothers me about America is that we can maximize our impact if we reach out to people who are different from ourselves. And I don't mean just racially different. I mean people who have different experiences and think differently than we do. And that's why I think this Ideas Festival is important. And I want to recommend a book. I sometimes do this when I come here. I'll recommend a book to you. I read a book written by a guy who coincidentally is a liberal Democrat. But no, wait till I tell you what the book says. It's called The Big Sort. His name is Bill Bishop, lives in Texas. And he says, okay, America is growing much more diverse as a country. We're more diverse racially and ethnically and religiously, and we're more tolerant of gays, and everything's great, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, we are growing more isolated in our communities because we are living more and more only with people we agree with. And we are growing more isolated in our political debates because we have access to more information than ever before. But we look at the television news and we read the websites of people who confirm what we think already. This is not good in a democracy. And I urge you to read it. I'll just give you one little factoid about it. In 1976, when President Carter and President Ford had a very close race for president, it was close in America. There were only 20% of our counties that voted for either one of them by more than 20%. In everybody else, every other place in America, there was a raging, ongoing debate among friends and neighbors and people that went to church or synagogue or, mosque or wherever together. They were all sitting there talking about this. And they were trying to build a sense of national unity out of their genuine concerns and debates. By 2004, when we had another close election between Senator Kerry and President Bush, it was also very close. But 48.5% of our counties voted for one or the other of them by more than 20 points. And Bishop has got a story in here, unbelievable story, about a brilliant developer in Southern California who did a market survey, and he found that in the area where he had the property, so he had to do the development, conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats were almost evenly divided. So, and he had one gated community he had to build. So on the left side, he built houses that suited conservative Republicans. And on the right side, he built places where you could have yoga and meditation and everything that suited liberal Democrats. And he actually sold it out immediately, divided exactly as he had predicted from his market surveys. Now, we're laughing about this, but some of us are going to have to cross the street, folks. That's the last thing I want to say to you. We got it. It was an amazing thing. So that's the other thing I would say to young people. Do public service not just with somebody who looks different than you do, but who thinks differently than you do. The way to we don't need a phony unity in this country. The founding fathers understood that debate and differences were healthy. But you have to have them in a way that allows you to see the person who disagrees with you as a human being. Once we start doing big things together, we'll figure out how to do it, and we'll do just fine. You should be actually quite optimistic. I never dreamed that I would see this level of commitment. But you should be worried about the climate change issue, this identity problem, and you should be really worried that your country's had more increase in inequality in this decade than at any time since the 1920s. It ought to bother you that I just went to a store down here that I used to visit every time when I came to Aspen, and they moved to a much smaller venue because they couldn't afford to rent anymore because things are so good here. But 90% of the benefits of this decade have gone to just 10% of us. And that ought to bother you. So you need to know there's tens of millions of your fellow Americans who, as we sit here and think about the higher things, are desperate. And every week they're deciding whether they can afford to fill up their gas tank and go to work or put food on the table for their kids. And so we don't need to get too smug here in whether we're Democrats or Republicans and how enlightened and concerned we are. We got a lot of big challenges. But as long as the young people of America define their citizenship as they seem to be determined to do, you should be optimistic about the future. Thank you.